Morning Show with Greg Berg is on the way next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we're going to be talking about the benefits of teaching your children a second language, the difference it can make in being bilingual. You'll be hearing from the co-authors of a book called The Bilingual Edge. But in part one, we're going to be talking about one of the most exciting and new undertakings artistically here in southeastern Wisconsin, the Kenosha Opera Festival. And I have with me Nick Huff, the general director and artistic director of the festival, and Kayla Bingen, who is the managing director. And we're going to be finding out from them what has been already going on with the Kenosha Opera Festival and what is coming up in terms of performances this weekend and the following weekend as well. It's a busy time, and thanks for making time, Nick Huff and Kayla Bingen.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Glad that we can have this chat. Nick, I think this was pretty much your brainchild in very capsule summary. Remind our listeners about the circumstances under which the Kenosha Opera Festival was created.
Sure. So I was a student of yours at Carthage, and I was put in charge of the branding and doing all kinds of public-facing things for the Carthage Opera. And so I was really enjoying that job. And I was looking around at Kenosha in that period and thinking, you know, Carthage isn't really designed to serve as the full professional opera company for all the great work they do. But it's strange that there's nothing here in this town for an opera company. And so I was, over the years, as I went off to grad school and went off into the professional world, I always thought back about home and thought, gosh, there should be something. Somebody should start something. I'd love to go home and sing. I'd love to have an opera company back home. And, you know, it didn't happen. Nobody seemed interested in taking that up. And I thought after a while, I could do that. So, you know, Kenosha is the perfect place for this kind of a company. And the reason is there's already such a strong artistic community there. We have a professional symphony orchestra. There are orchestras in all of the schools. That's a total rarity around the country and world. You know, it's a place where you get good audiences for classical music. It's really perfect. I mean, you've got places like Tenuta's. You walk in and hear Pavarotti singing. So we knew we were primed to have a good experience. And so I started asking around, and the short version of the story is everybody said, it's perfect. You should do it. So I did it. And the first thing I did was call up Kayla, a friend from my class in my year at Carthage, and a really wonderful administrative character. And the two of us sort of decided to set out about doing it. So we're kind of co-founders, and we both managed this thing. And this is our first live season. Our work anniversary was January 1st of 2020. So it was just to get held back by the pandemic. And now we're finally getting after some live performances, and it's been going really, really well so far. So we're hoping to finish strong this season. And we've had some events. We did the Kenosha Harbor Market just recently. Our fellows were singing there. We have a fellowship program. It's just for college students from Wisconsin or connected to Wisconsin. And they've been doing wonderfully. It's been really great. And the public has been responding well. So we've been very, very happy.
Cool. So you're the artistic and general director. Kayla, Give us some sense of your responsibilities as managing director. That sounds a little grittier than the person who gets to sit around and think up great ideas. I suspect the managing director in part has to implement those ideas.
Yeah, I think maybe in the past, Nick and I have described it as the less sexy work, not so romantic, but it is the work that I love doing. So I manage contracts, personnel management, a lot of the legal aspects, all the finances. So definitely those technical aspects that are the cogs and gears to making the season happen. But I love working from the inside there, and seeing us flourish there too, as people have come out of the woodwork to offer their services to help us. We have so many people that have donated their time, their skills, their knowledge to us this season, because they also believe in what we're doing. And it, that has been really rewarding to see that. And we exceeded our fundraising goal, which is also incredible. Once again, just shows that we have that incredible community buy-in here in Kenosha, that we're not just spouting off. We didn't just make something up. We are following through, and people believe in what we're doing as much as we do, which is amazing.
Fantastic. So, Nick, you already mentioned the presence of six young singers, the Fellows, who are part of the Kenosha Opera Festival, four women, two guys. And explain to our listeners what they have been busy with and the kind of performing and learning that has already been part of this experience for them.
Sure. So a fellowship program is something that's fairly, it's becoming common in the opera world. You know, sometimes it's called a young artist program or a studio, an opera studio. But the idea is it's entry level work for young singers, because it's tough. It's a tough industry. Everybody knows performing is tough, and it's tough to break in. And so you need experience. You need some way to get in and kind of learn the ropes and get your first performances in with a professional house. So we wanted to do that, and we wanted to do it specifically for Wisconsin singers. So the rule for applying for the fellowship is you're either from Wisconsin somewhere, or you're going to school here. So it's one of those two things. You have to have a serious connection to Wisconsin. And one thing I want to say about it is it's important. A lot of these summer young artist programs, you pay tuition, or you pay, you know, you're paying to fly to Italy. And that's great. I mean, I don't mean to knock anybody else's program, but they are not all made equal. And many of them, you are paying quite a lot of money for, you know, one role. You're basically buying a performance of a role. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to just basically find a cost neutral or close to cost neutral way to get this experience to kids that are from our state and from our community. And I'm really, really proud to say we actually were able to do that. There are a number of grants around Wisconsin, partners of ours, you know, supporters of opera singers, and the Aspire Center at Carthage, various others that make it possible for the kids to come, I shouldn't call them kids, for the young singers to come and be in Kenosha. And they all, you know, some have apartments, some are staying at school, and work with us. And we don't have to charge any tuition or put any burden on them at all. So they can come for absolutely free. And what we do is have classes in the morning and rehearsal in the afternoon. So every morning we've had somebody from the industry coming. The kind of highlight reel is we had a person who manages some Met Star social media accounts. Max Potter came and taught them about social media and how to work that for yourself professionally. We had a certified public accountant who is also a soprano, a working soprano. She came and explained the tax situation, which if you're a freelancer is very, tedious and tough. You get a lot of 1099s, no W-2s. So she helped them learn about that. And, she, you know, is obviously eminently qualified, almost could be a niche specialist in this. We've had people come and talk about Baroque ornaments. That's happening right now this morning. We've had somebody after that coming to talk about Bel Canto romantic ornaments, specifically things that maybe you get in school, you touch on, your teacher might tell you about, but this person is really a knowledge, a font of knowledge about it. And they're going to come and show you just basically what you need to do if you get hired to do a role in this style or whatever. So it's all kinds of stuff, the nitty gritty business side. We built websites, things that they need to know that is not necessarily going to get covered in aural skills or music theory. So things that we can help them with to set them up for success as professionals in opera.
And of course, Nick, you have gone on to do some professional opera singing after graduating from Carthage and then graduating from Eastman. And I suspect that some of these people that you are bringing in to be part of the festival are people that you have actually made contact with through Eastman or through your own professional contacts as a young opera singer.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, one thing I should say, actually, as I was wrapping it up, trying not to talk too long, I was thinking to myself, gosh, I should name drop some more people and thank them. Because I mean, yeah, so many of these people are just people that are giving their time, wonderful friends of ours. That CPA was named Nicole Keeling. She's a wonderful soprano out of Texas. Just yesterday, we had Rafael Porto and Kara Collins come. They just finished at a festival in Minnesota and they were coming through. They came and spoke to our kids. Catherine Cowdrick out of Eastman, wonderful professor of voice. That was actually Keeley, who's another member of the company, my fiance. She studied with Cowdrick at Eastman. All kinds of wonderful people. And they're all, you know, these giving folks who are excited about the idea of what we're doing for these kids and just jumping in to support it. All kinds of wonderful people from around the country and world.
And it sounds like at least some of these experiences are in person. They're not virtual, although virtual experiences can be great too, but at least some of these are in person.
Yes. Yeah. If it's possible. Sometimes it's, you know, prohibitive. We had somebody call in from California yesterday, so we didn't really have the budget to fly her out. I'm sorry to say it would have been nice to do that. But yeah, some are in person. When people are coming from Chicago or Indiana, as was the case yesterday, or Minnesota, we actually do have a couple coming up to work with the fellows. They're coming up from Arkansas. They teach at the University of Central Arkansas, or Arkansas Central University. So yeah, we do have some people coming in person. Everybody's vaccinated. We made sure to do this safely, but it's really made me smile the first day that we could all get together in a room and do this. Yeah, some of it is in person. It's been really exciting.
Fantastic. We're speaking with Nick Huff and Kayla Bingen about the Kenosha Opera Festival, a very new organization already doing exciting things. Before we get to a couple of fairly formal performances coming up this weekend, Kayla, talk for a moment about, for instance, the appearance that the Kenosha Opera Festival made at Kenosha Harbor Market, and I know at a recent Kenosha Kingfish ball game. I suspect you had a hand in getting those arranged, and maybe you could say a word about why you think those are worth the time and energy.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, of course, formal performances are a big part of our work, but we wanted to develop a specific initiative, even in our inaugural season, that can be representative of all the extra things that we want to do in our community. So we titled that initiative the Opera Round K-Town Program. And this is this massive umbrella of amazing events. It included a lot of educational initiatives, like the Emoji Goes to the Opera program we did with Carthage a few months ago. We performed at the Racine Zoo a week ago, which was amazing. Of course, National Anthem at the Kingfish game, appearing at the Harbor Market. We had an incredible crowd at the Kenosha Harbor Market. We're getting featured this upcoming weekend at the Kenosha Art Spotlight as part of the Kids from Wisconsin tour. So all these little pop-ups, all these little representations of what our company does and what we stand for and what's important to us while it being free and connecting with people that we may not normally get in the door for a very traditional operatic experience. But it's incredible at the Harbor Market, the conversations we had with people, the people that would stop at our booth and say, wow, I've never seen an opera. And we can say, well, I think what our marketing intern described it wonderfully as a French rom-com. Ah. And, you know, just being able to share that aspect of this really opulent kind of performance and making it accessible to everyone in our community, not just a certain group of people, not just people who have history with opera. It can be accessible to everybody.
Very good. So Nick, this weekend, a couple of different things are going on. One of them happens to be a one-act opera that I composed called Birds of a Feather, a sequel to The Magic Flute of Mozart. And I know this is a performance that you're excited about because it's going to involve, we presume, an audience mostly of young kids. Tell us about when that's going to happen and if it's okay for a couple of adults to peek into the audience as well.
Sure. Yeah, so it's a wonderful little piece. I remember you wrote this a few years ago, and when I heard that you had done that, I asked you to send me this, but the company didn't exist yet, but I asked you to send it to me, and I listened to it and just thought it was charming as all get out. So when we did start this company, I thought, well, you know, we want to do some community programming. It's important to us. And we were talking, and right away, both of us thought, actually, Birds of a Feather would be perfect. So just kind of almost slotted in naturally on its own. It's a great piece with the it being a sequel to The Magic Flute, takes the characters of Magic Flute Papageno and Papagena to a bird catcher and his the love interest that he meets during the course of events in The Magic Flute. And one of their big duets is all about the kids they're going to have. First, we'll have a Papageno, then we'll have a Papagena, Papageno, Papagena, and they go back and forth talking about all the boys and girls they're going to have. And it's a very, very sweet little duet. You've quoted most, I'm not sure if it's all of it, but a big chunk of it in the start of the piece. And it's extremely charming. It's Mozart's, some of Mozart's most captivating, charming little music. And anyway, over the course of your opera, the kids that they have kind of struggle with the identities that their parents are putting on them of all the things that a boy should do or a girl should do. And they sort of, that's the central conflict, is their what their parents think they should be doing and what they want to do. And so it's a great little piece about accepting people for who they are. And we love the message of it, and we love the music. It's this beautiful, lush, sounds great on the piano with the voices. Piece. And so we programmed it for Friday. We're partnering with the Kenosha Public Library. It'll be at 7 p.m., but you can come before that. And yes, definitely adults are welcome. We're hoping whole families will come. We're kind of thinking of it as a family event. So there will be a book sale going on that the library is putting on. We'll be performing at 7. And of course, there's going to be all kinds of fun going on. There's a little truck coming, a Kona ice truck. So even if it's a hot day, don't let that scare you away. There's something cool there that you could get. And it should be a lot of fun.
And that's at the Northside Kenosha Public Library, right?
That is at the Northside Library. That's right. Yeah, there are a few libraries in town. You could get confused. This is the Northside. The kids have been working on this for the past week or so, and week or two, and it's really coming along. Just finished staging it. Keely Feuder, who is the director of the fellowship, is staging it. So working with you as you're the music director, and I can tell you, everybody that's listening, it is extremely charming. I think your kids will love it, and you even might really love it. It's a great little piece.
So again, people are hearing this Friday morning. So this performance we're talking about is tonight at 7 o'clock at the Northside Kenosha Public Library. Admission absolutely free. And then this weekend, something else is going on that I think is especially keeping the fellows of the Kenosha Opera Alliance busy.
Yeah, they are busy. This is the fellows' big weekend. So Saturday evening, they have their very own fellowship spotlight recital, which is going to be at the Kenosha Creative Space at 7 p.m. And this is completely additional repertoire. So it's not the same thing that you're going to be seeing Friday night from them. This is a lot of solo and ensemble pieces that they've been preparing over the last several weeks and getting coached on. They've been working tremendously hard, and it's going to be incredibly entertaining. I've been, you know, popping into a few rehearsals and reading some of the notes, and it sounds like they are going to be putting on an incredible performance. And that is also a free event. So that is free to the public Saturday evening at 7 p.m. at Kenosha Creative Space.
Kenosha Creative Space. So Saturday night, tomorrow night, 7 p.m., a spotlight in which these six very, very talented young singers We'll be performing in a variety of arias and so on. And then, Nick, after that, we just have a couple of minutes to talk about this, but the big full-length opera that is going to be mounted is kind of the climactic event of this year's Kenosha Opera Festival. Tell our listeners about Donizetti's The Daughter of the Regiment.
Yes. So this is the one we were referencing earlier when we said it's kind of like a French rom-com. And the reason that my intern said that was because it's really, really charming, sweet music. It's the kind of story that is not some over-heavy opera thing. The quick version is it's wartime Europe, and a French military regiment out in the theater of war finds an orphaned young girl and adopt her. They raise her, and when she's older, she actually falls in love with a young man from the other side of the conflict, which, as you can imagine, all of these adoptive fathers of the regiment do not approve of that. And so he has to jump through all kinds of hoops to try and get their approval and allow him to be with this young girl. Her name's Marie, and his name is Tonio. And it's just a darling little piece. It's really, really fun. It takes place in wartime, but it's not nitty gritty. It's very sweet and charming, and it's got a lot of heart, and not to mention a lot of vocal fireworks. This opera is famous for an aria with 9 high Cs for the tenor, and the soprano sings a lot of crazy high flying stuff, including a few high E flats, I think she's got interpolated in there. So you will not be bored musically, and it's also going to be a really entertaining piece. We're doing it with live orchestra too, by the way, so there really is a lot to take in when you come on August 6th and 7th. This is at the Rode Center for the Arts downtown.
And we'll remind people a little closer to that of those performances of Donizetti's The Daughter of the Regiment, a really, really delicious, fun comedy. In the meantime, Kayla, let's remind everybody about what is happening this weekend with the Kenosha Opera Festival.
Absolutely. So this evening, so today's Friday, this evening, come to the North Side Library, starting at 6:30, but the official performance starts at 7 p.m. The fellows will be performing Birds of a Feather, a wonderful opera. Will be a food truck and lots of additional fun activities as part of nights at the library. And then tomorrow evening, Saturday, you will find the fellows once again performing at the Kenosha Creative Space at 7 p.m., their very own spotlight recital.
Very good. And we want to let everybody know that these 6 young people are indeed very, very talented. And a couple of them are actually from Kenosha originally, so people can come and cheer on a couple of Kenosha heroines. Nick Huff, Artistic and General Director of the Kenosha Opera Festival, and Kayla Bingen, Managing Director. Thanks for your time. Good to talk with both of you. It's great to see the success of the Kenosha Opera Festival. I hope a lot of people will come out and take in the performances. Thanks again for being part of the program today.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Greg.
I want to add that the 6 young aspiring opera singers who are the fellows in this year's Kenosha Opera Festival include 2 young people originally from Kenosha who are now students at Carthage, London Roysden and Savannah Krieger. Also with London and Savannah are 3 other Carthage students, Katie Ann Nelson, Corey Pollard, and Katrina Seabright. One more reminder that the performance tonight of Birds of a Feather, a magic flute sequel, will be at 7 o'clock at the Northside Kenosha Public Library. Admission is free. The public is invited to attend. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here is part 2 from the Morning Show Archives. I am very excited about the topic which we are exploring today. It's one which has actually been of interest to me for a long, long time. Back in the early 1980s, when I was in graduate school, the gentleman who was the staff accompanist at the University of Nebraska had a young child and was teaching her baby girl German along with English. And I remember seeing this with my own eyes, hearing it with my own eyes, and just thinking it was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever heard of. I didn't know at that point anybody who was interested in teaching their young baby two different languages at once. And over the years, I have found out that this was not at all an isolated instance, that in fact, there's quite a number of parents, more and more, in fact, who are interested in exploring this. And so I'm very happy to be able to explore this now in a little more serious way with the authors of a book called The Bilingual Edge, Why, When, and How to Teach Your Child a Second Language. We're going to be speaking today with Dr. Kendall King and Dr. Allison Mackey, who are both linguistics professors at Georgetown University. They have done a lot of writing on the topic of bilingualism and the teaching of language, and this is a personal story for both of them in that they are both parents who have had this experience of teaching their children more than one language. So we have a lot to explore as we talk about this very interesting book published by HarperCollins. And Dr. Kendall King, Dr. Allison Mackey, we welcome you both to the morning show.
Thank you. We're delighted to be here.
Good to be having you with us. Help us understand just how widespread a phenomenon this is and if it's something which is actually growing in importance, as it seems to, as far as I can tell.
Absolutely. I think you touch on a really key point there. And in fact, we, as you mentioned, are academic researchers. We spend most of our life doing research on second language acquisition and bilingualism for other researchers, for the most part, like all academics. And it really wasn't until we had our own children a few years ago that, and as we started to chat with parents on playgrounds and in the grocery store line, we realized how many parents out there were interested in promoting a second language with their child on the one hand, and on the other, how little accessible information there is for parents. The research field has made huge advances in the last few decades, but there really wasn't a place where parents could get that information in a way that was really meaningful and that they could apply to their own context.
So can you give us, is it possible to quantify just where this happens and how much it happens? I mean, do we see this all across the country, or more in, you know, more sophisticated urban centers? And I mean, are there any kinds of families who seem drawn to this interesting possibility?
I think you're right that this is a growing trend. There was a recent survey that showed that two-thirds of all adults wish they had studied more foreign language in high school. I think many of us have sort of bad memories of studying French or Spanish for a year or two in high school and then having the frustrating experience of not being able to use the language effectively if they happen to meet someone for that country or from that country. And parents now realize that those sorts of old approaches don't work and want something better and different for their own children. And that's really what this is a book is about, how parents can help children to achieve all of the advantages that come with bilingualism, the academic advantages as well as the cultural and social advantages.
And to follow that up a little bit and put it into a more global context, what we know is that millions of children all over the world routinely grow up as bilingual or multilingual. Here in the United States and a few other English-speaking countries like England, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, monolingualism is the norm. Bilingualism is the goal for a lot of people, but monolingualism is the norm.
You outline early on in the book some of the potential advantages of a young child being bilingual, and some of these are maybe a little beyond the obvious. Tell us a couple of the most important ways in which a youngster being bilingual can be of real benefit to them.
Sure. I mean, there's so many reasons, and really the different reasons are going to be important for different parents. But the ones we talk about in some detail in the book include the intellectual advantages. So, for instance, children who are proficient in two languages outperform monolinguals on specific intelligent tests, and in particular those which relate to reading readiness. So that's a huge issue in schools and an important advantage you can give your children. There's also strong research evidence that there are cultural or relational advantages. That is, children who know more than one language are more likely to make friends with children from different language groups and different ethnic groups. That's increasingly important in today's society. And in addition, we know when children get a bit older that they're also going to have economic advantages. Bilinguals outperform, out-earn monolinguals on the job market. So there are many, many advantages, not just one.
Hmm. The last one, I think, is absolutely unquestionable. The first couple that you talked about and others which you talk about in the book as well, that, for instance, bilingual children tend to be more creative and have better skills at focusing and so on. One thing I just wonder, though, is how do we know what comes first? Because it seems like it might be that bright children or families that are already very intellectually stimulating are also the families that are going to be drawn to this possibility. How much do we really know that these advantages spring from being bilingual, that being bilingual is creating some of what you were just describing?
Right. That's an important question, and social scientists spend a lot of time trying to differentiate what things are causally related versus correlated, and they're two different things, of course. We know that there's a causal relationship here because we have many, many studies. By causal relationship, I mean that bilingualism promotes specific sorts of cognitive advantages because we have many, many studies looking at thousands of children from lots of different contexts, with very different social backgrounds and very different aptitude sets. So just as Allison was mentioning that bilingualism is the norm, we have lots of studies from different parts of the world where all children routinely become bilingual. It's only in the U.S. and a few other places where it tends to be sort of an elite phenomenon. But in much of the world, all children learn 2, 3, 4 languages just as a routine part of growing up.
Hmm.
And it's important also to see that in the United States, bilingualism is not just for the wealthy elite, but that many, many immigrants come to this country with almost nothing, and their children are growing up bilingual. Those advantages that we mention are true for their children as well. And one more that people often find interesting, the very latest research suggests that the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is actually much lower in bilinguals who are fluent in both languages, additively fluent. So there are advantages at the very later stages of life as well as at the beginning of life.
Wow.
Yeah, that's an important point. And I just want to follow up by, even though I was talking about elitism, the message of this book is that bilingualism benefits all children, and that both types of parents, by both types I mean English-speaking parents who hope to introduce a second language, can benefit from this book, as well as parents who maybe already have a non-English language in their home and are concerned about maintaining that language, be it Arabic or Spanish or Chinese, as well as promoting English for their children.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Kendall King and Dr. Allison Mackey about their book called The Bilingual Edge: Why, When, and How to Teach Your Child a Second Language. The point you were just making about how this is really something that only elite families might enjoy is, of course, one of a number of myths about bilingualism, which your book lists at one point. And it's really quite interesting. I mean, some of the alarm bells which some people might raise, which in fact don't need to have any... that we really, in fact, don't need to be all that concerned about. One that that really struck me is kind of interesting is the myth that mixing languages in the home is going to create confusion, and that separating the languages cleanly is the best way for children to learn language at all. I mean, one can understand how someone might sort of concoct that myth, but you firmly believe that in fact is not the case.
Well, and it's not just that we believe this. There's lots of evidence that shows this to be the case. So what this is probably one of the biggest concerns that parents have, that is that their children might be confused, they might be delayed, if if they're exposed to two languages from an early age. And the research is quite clear. Children do not become confused. All children, when they're developing, if they're exposed to two languages, do typically go through a period of mixing those two languages, but it's typically very short term. It's not a sign of any sort of problem, but it's a natural part of sorting out those two systems.
Hmm.
It's absolutely nothing for parents to worry about.
This person that I knew back in the early 1980s, back in Lincoln, Nebraska, I can still remember so vividly with his very, very young daughter. Mm-hmm. He raised his hand and said, "What is this?" And she said, "It's your hand." And then he, in the next instance, asked, "Was ist das?" And she immediately responded, "Das Hand," or "Dein Hand," or I forget what exactly she said, but the point was she answered the German question in German and the English question in English without any problem whatsoever. And that was a huge revelation for me just in that instant, that such a thing indeed would be possible, and probably for the youngster in question, a lot of fun.
Yeah, and not only a lot of fun, but very good for them intellectually. Think about what that child is doing. She's learning that there are two words for one object. That's a pretty important lesson for all kids to get, and that it's possible to move back and forth. And when children are exposed to two languages, that's a little bit of an artificial example that you gave, but you know, in a home when two languages are being spoken, children learn very quickly to differentiate which language to use with which parent, and even from a very young age, how to use which language in the right way to get the cookie that they want or the television program. So children are very sharp at picking that up, and there's no risk involved, I guess is what I mean to say.
Hmm. You devote quite a sizable portion of the book to kind of a dual question, which is very interesting to ponder. Which language and when? And both of those are really juicy questions. Let's start with the first one, and that is, what should that second language in the home be? And you outline a number of different things which a family might want to consider in making a good choice here. Explain a couple of the most important.
Well, a lot of families already have a heritage language in the home, or one of the parents speaks the language fluently, or maybe both. And for those families, which is quite an easy question to answer. In my own case, for example, we didn't have an obvious second language in the family. Neither my husband nor I are fluent speakers of any second language. And that's another message of the book, that you don't need to be a fluent native speaker in order to introduce your child to more than one language. What you do need to do is take an inventory of what's around you and what's going to impact your success. So in the book, we talk about exactly how to do this with a checklist. One of the things is to look around you in the community. What sort of resources are there? How many speakers of what sort of languages are around? Can you find bilingual parenting groups or bilingual play groups? Can you find bilingual story hours at the local library? Can you find music and movement classes in the second language? What we know is that human languages are learned through interaction with other humans. So what you're looking for is people, not just you, for your child to be able to interact with. So in choosing which language, that's one of the concerns. Another concern is, what is it that you want for your child in the end? Are you looking for them to communicate, and how? And that leads us into the next question of when. So, for example, if you're looking for your child to become a very proficient native-like sounding speaker, so a person who sounds almost like a native of the language, then it's best if you can introduce your child to the second language very early on. We know that early is very much the best for accents. However, later can be fine also, because research has shown us that older children sometimes learn a bit faster because of their greater cognitive maturity. They're more able to pick things up, certain grammar points, quicker. So the message of the book in relation to when is, it's never too early and it's never too late. And the message in relation to which is, look around you and see what's available to you. How are you going to be helped, and how can you get the most human interaction?
Just to follow up, people oftentimes ask us, which language is going to be easier or harder? And our message is that that question is much less important than which languages surround you in your home, in your community, and that's going to have a much greater impact on determining your ultimate level of success.
Back to the when for just a moment, because I think a very interesting point raised in your book, which I would love to hear you just expand on just a moment, is the capacity that babies, I mean infants, have a capacity which apparently we lose at some point thereafter. You say babies do not know where they are going to live and what language they will need to speak, so they need to be born with the ability to hear the difference between all sounds.
That's right.
And this is a skill apparently at some point which declines. Tell us a little more about how we know this and what the significance of this is within the topic that we're discussing today.
Sure. So as you say, all babies are born citizens of the world, right? They don't know where they're going to be born, and they have the capacity to learn any language. However, we know that this capacity starts to diminish around 8-9 months of age. So researchers have been able to test this by using different sorts of techniques you can use with infants, such as pacifiers, which are hooked up to monitors, so you can judge how quickly the child is sucking. So children are going to suck harder and faster when they hear a new sound. So when they're very, very small, they will hear differences between two sounds in a language that we can no longer hear. However, around 8-9 months, they begin to lose that capacity. And two things are really happening here. They're beginning to tune in to their own language. Around this time, children are beginning to speak their first words around 1 year of age. So it makes sense they're tuning into their own language. And they're beginning to tune out, that is, to no longer to be able to hear, to discriminate between sounds in a language to which they're not exposed. And so that relates to what Allison was saying, in that younger is better in terms of accent, in that sort of perceptual or sound discrimination seems to be one of the features of language which is most sensitive to age. However, it's not impossible. It's not. Certainly, there are people who learn a language a bit, beyond year one or year two, and sound very, very proficient, almost native-like. It just that it becomes a bit more difficult as we mature.
A lot of your book deals with how this is implemented. If parents make the decision to do this, and once you've chosen what the language will be and maybe chosen when in the child's life this second language will be introduced, then you give us just a host of ideas about the best way to do it. It seems to me that two of the themes which seem to predominate, I mean, across various age groups and so on, is first of all the idea of having fun, of making it fun, and the idea of incorporating the use of the second language into the texture of everyday life. Let's talk about both of those principles and some of the specific ways in which you suggest that those be acted out.
Thanks. That's a very nice summary of what we were trying to do, so we appreciate it. Yeah. In relation to keeping it fun, we have found in our own lives, as well as looking at the research findings, that children really won't make a big deal of learning a second language if you don't make a big deal of it either. If you introduce it as a routine part of life, and if you make sure that, for example, when they're playing with the cool kids on the playground, that both languages are available to them in the playground, then they'll enjoy it. It will be a part of what they're doing. They will see it as routine. They will pick it up, and they will not go through, difficult periods with it. However, we do in the book also talk about, and for your listeners, sometimes this is a question that comes up, what happens when children do what happens when they do argue a little bit with using the second language, particularly with toddlers who are liable to argue with you for anything, even wearing a T-shirt. So we go through some of the tips and tricks that you can use then to keep your toddler on board with the second language, associating it with particular toys, incentivizing children at different ages with different ways. So, for example, toddlers, it's toys. With older children, it can be more advanced things like the prospect of a trip abroad, a meal out, possibly even some kind of education and entertainment at the same time. there are many ways that you can keep that language as part of something which is a happy, active process within the home.
Hmm. And just to follow up, I think it's important to recognize that it's very hard to make children do something they don't want to do. And I think language is perhaps even more true of that than eating your vegetables or wearing your socks in the winter. We really can't make children do anything. The most we can do is set up the opportunities and the incentives for them to want to use the language. And so that's really the framework that we use when we approach this topic. And as you say, we have lots of tips and tricks to try to make that work for children of different ages and with different interests.
Hmm. How much of this book stems out of your own personal experience as mothers doing this with your own children?
Well, part of the reason we wrote the book, as Kendall said earlier, is because we really crossed the threshold from our lives as academics and researchers into our lives as parents about 3.5 years ago when we had our children. And we found that not only we wanted to expose our children to more than one language, but also other parents had lots and lots of questions for us. First of all, when they saw us doing it, but secondly, just when they found out, oh, you're linguists. Well, I want to teach my child a language. How do you do it? What, you know, what sort of things do I need to consider? When should I do it? Which language? Is that a difficult language? Well, as soon as we got to that stage, we started to look around the popularly available parenting literature and the education literature to find some book that we could be recommending. But as it turned out, there actually wasn't anything popularly available. So that's why we put our heads together and decided to write the book, because there really was nothing available at the time.
Hmm.
As we wrote it, and it took us, you know, a year or two to write it, our own experiences came through in that we talked about the things that we ourselves had faced and were facing, because it is a process. Learning a language is not like riding a bike when it stops. It's a lifelong process.
Hmm.
And I just to follow up with this. So certainly sort of some of the inspiration and the motivation to write this book was born with our own children. But at the same time, it's not a book about our experiences solely, or it's not even about our theories of language learning. You know, parents buy lots and lots of books. I probably have 10 books on sleep, how to get your child to sleep, on my shelf. And each one is typically a one person's theory about how what worked for them and what they think parents should do. This is a book that's really based on decades of social science and hard science from across a number of different fields, synthesized in a way that parents can access, and sprinkled with lots of anecdotes, both from ourselves and from our friends and parents who we know through our research.
And, of course, all put together in a very, very accessible sort of way. I mean, that's one of the things that impressed me most about this book, is that for as much as it is based in strong scholarly research, this is also not an intimidating scholarly tome when you sort of feel like you need a master's degree just to buy it at the bookstore. But, I mean, this is a book written with regular people in mind.
Thanks. That was our aim, to talk to our friends and our family.
The book again is.
One reviewer said it was like. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say one review. One, the best review we got. A reviewer said it was like having coffee with us. So that was the goal.
Very good. The book again is called "The Bilingual Edge: Why, When, and How to Teach Your Child a Second Language," filled with all sorts of interesting tips on how to do this well, and a lot of writing on why it's an important thing to do. And the book is published by HarperCollins. The authors, Dr. Kendall King, Dr. Allison Mackey. I thank both of you for writing this very interesting book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, two really interesting conversations from the past, including one with violinist Rachel Barton. The occasion was her playing with the Kenosha Symphony to help them celebrate their 60th anniversary season. Rachel Barton was recently in the news when she deputized on just a few hours' notice, soloing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at Ravinia. On Sunday, Jerry Renau Some of you have perhaps seen him on stage with the Racine Theatre Guild and other local theatre companies. This was a conversation from 2000 in which he talks about his book, Writing for Television Comedy. Jerry Renau was a busy comedy writer in Hollywood for a number of years, writing for an array of different shows. On Monday, we talk about the King of Rock and Roll, Chuck Berry, with Bruce Pegg, responsible for the definitive biography of Chuck Berry. The occasion of our conversation is a PBS documentary on Chuck Berry, which is going to be airing on Tuesday night. Tuesday morning, we have Dr. Art Sear back with us for his monthly visit to the morning show. On Wednesday, Nan Calvert and her monthly visit to the program. She'll be joined by P.J. Leash, who is with the UW-Madison Department of Entomology, Insect Diagnostic